and I questioned your judgment or didn't do as I was bid. Then you would deal with me the way you dealt with Jenya and your mother, the way you tried to deal with Mal. He leaned against the window, and the gilded frame came into sharp focus.
Do you think it would be any different with your tracker beside you? With that Lansov pup?
Yes, I said simply.
Because you would be the strong one?
Because they're better men than you.
You might make me a better man.
And you might make me a monster.
I've never understood this taste for Otkazatsia. Is it because you thought you were one of them for so long?
I had a taste for you once. His head snapped up. He hadn't expected that. Saints, it was satisfying.
Why haven't you visited me? I asked. In all these long months.
He stayed silent. There was barely a day at the little palace when you didn't come to me, I continued. When I didn't see you in some shadowed corner, I thought I was going mad.
Good.
I think you're afraid.
How comforting that must be for you.
I think you fear this thing that binds us. It didn't frighten me, not anymore. I took a slow step forward. He tensed, but did not move away.
I am ancient, Alina. I know things about power that you can barely guess at.
But it's not just power, is it? I said quietly, remembering the way he had toyed with me when I'd first arrived at the palace, even before, from the first moment we'd met. I'd been a lonely girl, desperate for attention. I must have given him so little sport. I took another step. He stilled. Our bodies were almost touching now. I reached up and cupped his cheek with my hand. This time, the flash of confusion on his face was impossible to miss. He held himself frozen, his only movement the steady rise and fall of his chest. Then, as if in concession, he let his eyes close. A line appeared between his brows. "It's true," I said softly. "You are stronger, wiser, infinite in experience." I leaned forward and whispered, my lips brushing the shell of his ear. "But I am an apt pupil." His eyes flew open. I caught the briefest glimpse of rage in his gray gaze before I severed the connection. I scattered, hurtling back to the White Cathedral, leaving him with nothing but the memory of light. Chapter 4. I sat up with a gasp, sucking in the damp air of the alabaster chamber. I looked around guiltily. I shouldn't have done it. What had I learned? That he was at the Grand Palace and in disgustingly good health? Paltry information. But I wasn't sorry. Now I knew what he saw when he visited me, what information he could or couldn't cull from the contact. Now I had practice in one more power that had only belonged to him, and I'd enjoyed it. At the little palace I dreaded those visions, thought I might be losing my mind, and worse. I wondered what they said about me. No longer. I was done being ashamed. Let him feel what it was to be haunted. A headache was starting in my right temple. I sought Moritzova's amplifiers for you, Alina. Lies disguised as truth. He'd sought to make me more powerful, but only because he believed he could control me. He still believed it, and that scared me. The Darkling had no way of knowing that Mal and I knew where to start looking for the third amplifier, but he hadn't seemed concerned. He hadn't even mentioned the Firebird. He'd seemed confident, strong, as if he belonged in that palace and on that throne. I know things about power that you can barely guess at. I gave myself a shake. I might not be a threat, but I could become one. I wouldn't let him beat me before I had a chance to give him the fight he deserved. A quick knock came at the door. It was time. I shoved my feet back into my boots and adjusted my scratchy golden kefta. After this, maybe I'd give myself a treat and stuff the thing in a stew pot. The services were quite a spectacle. It was still a challenge to summon so far underground, but I threw blazing light over the walls of the White Cathedral, drawing on every reserve to all the crowd that moaned and swayed below. Vladim stood to my left, his shirt open to display the brand of my palm on his chest. To my right, the apparat held forth, and whether out of fear or real belief, he did a very convincing job of it. His voice rang through the main cavern, claiming that our mission was guided by divine providence and that I would emerge from my trials more powerful than ever before. I studied him as he spoke. He looked paler than usual, a bit sweaty, though not particularly chastened. I wondered if it was a mistake to leave him alive, but without the rush of fury and power guiding my actions, execution wasn't a step I was prepared to consider seriously. A hush had fallen. I looked down into the eager faces of the people below. There was something new in their exultation, maybe because they'd gotten a glimpse of my real power, or maybe because the apparat had done his work so well. They were waiting for me to say something. I'd had dreams like this. I was an actor in a play, but I'd never learned my lines. I will... My voice cracked. I cleared my throat and tried again. I will return more powerful than before, I said in my best saint's voice. You are my eyes. I needed them to be, to watch the apparat, to keep each other safe. You are my fists. You are my swords. The crowd cheered. As one, they chorused back to me. Sancta Alina, Sancta Alina, Sancta Alina. Not bad, Mal said as I stepped away from the balcony. I've been listening to the apparat go on for nearly 3 months. Something had to rub off. On my orders, the apparat announced that he would spend 3 days in isolation, fasting and praying for the success of our mission. The priest guards would do the same, confined to the archives and guarded by the Soldat Sol. Keep them strong in their faith, I told Ruby and the other soldiers. I hoped that 3 days would give us plenty of time to get well away from the White Cathedral. But knowing the apparat, he'd probably talk his way out before dinner. I knew you, Ruby said, clutching my fingers as I turned to go. I was in your regiment. Do you remember? Her eyes were wet, and the tattoo on her cheek was so black it seemed to float on top of her skin. Of course I do, I said kindly. We hadn't been friends. Back then, Ruby had been more interested in Mal than religion. I'd been nearly invisible to her. Now she released a sob and pressed a kiss to my knuckles. Sancta, she whispered fervently. Whenever I thought my life couldn't get any stranger, it did. Once I'd disentangled myself from Ruby, I took a final moment to speak to the apparat in private. You know what I'm going after, priest, and you know the power I'll wield when I return. Nothing happens to the Soldat Sol or to Maxim. I didn't like leaving the healer on his own here, but I wouldn't command him to join us, not knowing the dangers we might face on the surface.
We are not enemies. Sancta Alina, the apparat said gently. You must know that all I've ever wanted was to see you on Ravka's throne.
I almost smiled at that. I know, priest. On the throne and under your thumb. He tilted his head to one side, contemplating me. The fanatical glint was gone from his eyes. He simply looked shrewd.
You are not what I expected, he admitted.
Not quite the saint you bargained for?
A lesser saint, he said. But perhaps a better queen. I will pray for you, Alina Starkov.
The strange thing was, I believed him. Mal and I met the others at Chetya's Well, a natural fountain at the crossroads of four of the major tunnels. If the apparat did decide to send a party after us, we'd be harder to track from there. At least that was the idea, but we hadn't bargained on so many of the pilgrims turning out to see us off. They'd followed the Grisha from their quarters and crowded around the fountain. We were all in ordinary travel clothes, our kefta stowed in our packs. I'd exchanged my gold robes for a heavy coat, a fur hat, and the comforting weight of a gun belt at my hip. If it hadn't been for my white hair, I doubted any of the pilgrims would have recognized me. Now they reached out to touch my sleeve or my hand. Some pressed little gifts on us, the only offerings they had, hoarded bread rolls gone tooth-breakingly hard, polished stones, bits of lace, a clutch of salt lilies. They murmured prayers for our health with tears in their eyes. I saw Jenya's surprise when a woman placed a dark green prayer shawl around her shoulders.
Not black, she said. For you, not black.
An ache began in my throat. It wasn't just the apparat who had kept me isolated from these people. I'd distanced myself from them as well. I'd distrusted their faith, but mostly I feared their hope. The love and care in these tiny gestures was a burden I didn't want. I kissed cheeks, shook hands, made promises I wasn't sure I could keep, and then we were on our way. I'd been carried into the White Cathedral on a stretcher. At least I was leaving on my feet. Mal took the lead. Tolya and Tamar brought up the rear, scouting behind us to make sure that no one followed. Through David's access to the archives and Mal's innate sense of direction, they'd managed to construct a rough map of the tunnel network. They had started plotting a course to Rivost, but there were gaps in their information. No matter how accurate they'd been, we couldn't be sure of what we might be walking into. After my escape from Os Alta, the Darkling's men had tried to penetrate the network of tunnels beneath Ravka's churches and holy sites. When their searches turned up empty, they'd begun bombing, closing off exit routes, trying to drive anyone seeking shelter to the surface. The Darkling's alchemy had created new explosions that collapsed buildings and forced combustible gases below ground. All it took was a single Inferni spark, and whole sections of the ancient network of tunnels collapsed. It was one of the reasons the apparat had insisted I remain at the White Cathedral. There were rumors of cave-ins to the west of us, so Mal led us north. It wasn't the most direct route, but we hoped it would be stable. It was a relief to be moving through the tunnels, to finally be doing something after so many weeks of confinement. My body was still weak, but I felt stronger than I had in months, and I pushed onward without complaint. I tried not to think too hard about what it would mean if the smuggling station at Rivost wasn't active. How were we supposed to find a prince who didn't want to be found, and do it while remaining hidden ourselves? If Nikolai was alive, he might be looking for me, or he might have sought alliance elsewhere. For all he knew, I had died in the battle at the Little Palace. The tunnels grew darker as we moved farther from the White Cathedral and its strange alabaster glow. Soon our way was lit by nothing but the swaying light of our lanterns. In some places, the caverns were so narrow that we had to remove our packs and wriggle along between the press of walls. Then, without warning, we'd find ourselves in a giant cave wide enough to pasture horses. Mal had been right. So many people traveling together were noisy and unwieldy. We made frustratingly slow progress, marching in a long column with Zoya, Nadia, and Adric spread out along the line. In case of a cave-in, the air our squalors could summon might provide valuable breathing time for anyone trapped. David and Jenya kept falling behind, but he seemed to be the one responsible for the lag. Finally, Tolia hefted the huge pack from David's narrow shoulders. He groaned.
"What do you have in this thing?"
3 pairs of socks, 1 pair of trousers, an extra shirt, 1 canteen, a tin cup and plate, a cylindrical slide rule, a chronometer, a jar of spruce sap, my collection of anti-corrosives.
You are only supposed to pack what you need.
David gave an emphatic nod.
Exactly.
Please tell me you didn't bring all of Moritzova's journals, I said.
Of course I did.
I rolled my eyes. There had to be at least 15 leather-bound books. Maybe they'll make good kindling.
Is she kidding?
David asked, looking concerned.
I can never tell if she's kidding.
I was. Mostly. I'd hoped the journals would give me insight into the Firebird and maybe even into how the amplifiers could help me destroy the Fold. But they'd been a dead end, and if I was honest, they frightened me a little too. Bagra had warned me of Moritzova's madness, and yet somehow I'd expected to find wisdom in his work. Instead, his journals had provided me with a study in obsession, all of it documented in nearly indecipherable scrawl. Apparently, genius didn't require good penmanship. His early journals chronicled his experiments. The blacked-out formula for liquid fire, a means of preventing organic decay, the trials that had led to the creation of Grisha steel, a method for restoring oxygen to the blood, the endless year he'd spent finding a way to create unbreakable glass. His skills extended beyond those of an ordinary fabricator, and he was well aware of it. One of the essential tenets of Grisha theory was, like calls to like, but Moritzova seemed to believe that if the world could be broken down to the same small parts, each Grisha should be able to manipulate them. "Are we not all things?" he demanded, underlining the words for emphasis. He was arrogant, audacious, but still sane. Then his work on the amplifiers had begun, and even I could see the change. The text got denser, messier. The margins were full of diagrams and crazed arrows that referred back to earlier passages. Worse were the descriptions of experiments he'd performed on animals. The illustrations of his dissections. They turned my stomach and made me think Moritzova had deserved whatever early martyrdom he'd received. He'd killed animals and then brought them back to life, sometimes repeatedly, delving deeper into Merzost, creation, the power of life over death, trying to find a way to create amplifiers that might be used together. It was forbidden power, but I knew its temptation, and I shuddered to think that pursuing it might have driven him mad. If he was led by some noble purpose, I didn't see it in his pages. But I'd sensed something more in his fevered writings, in his insistence that power was everywhere for the taking. He had lived long before the creation of the Second Army. He was the most powerful Grisha the world had ever known, and that power had isolated him. I remembered the Darkling's words to me. "There are no others like us, Alina, and there never will be." Maybe Moritzova wanted to believe that if there were no others like him, there could be, that he might create Grisha of greater power. Or maybe I was just imagining things, seeing my own loneliness and greed in Moritzova's pages,
The mess of what I knew and what I wanted, my desire for the Firebird, my own sense of difference, had all gotten too hard to untangle. I was pulled from my thoughts by the sound of rushing water. We were approaching an underground river. Mal slowed our pace and had me walk directly behind him, casting light over the path. It was a good thing, too, because the drop came fast, so steep and sudden that I slammed right into his back, nearly knocking him over the edge and into the water below. Here the roar was deafening, the river rushing past at uncertain depth, plumes of mist rising from the rapids. We tied a rope around Tolia's waist, and he waded across, then secured it on the other side so we could follow, one by one, attached to the line. The water was ice-cold and came all the way up to my chest, the force of it pulling me nearly off my feet as I held on to the rope. Harshaw was the last to cross. I had a moment of terror when he lost his footing and the tether nearly snapped free. Then he was up, gasping for breath, on Cat, soaked to the skin and spitting mad. By the time Harshaw reached us, his face and neck were a patchwork of tiny scratches. After that, we were all eager to stop, but Mal insisted we keep going.
"I'm drenched," Zoya groused. "Why can't we stop in this dank cave instead of the next dank cave?"
Mal didn't break stride, but hooked a thumb back at the river.
"Because of that," he shouted over the din of rushing water. "If we've been followed, it will be too easy for someone to sneak up on us with that noise as cover."
Zoya scowled, but we pushed on until finally we outdistanced the river's clamor. We spent the night in a hollow of damp limestone, where there was nothing to hear but our teeth chattering as we shivered in our wet clothes. For 2 days we carried on like that, moving through the tunnels, occasionally backtracking when a route proved impassable. I'd lost all sense of what direction we were heading, but when Mal announced that we were turning west, I noticed that the passages were sloping upward, leading us toward the surface. Mal set an unforgiving pace. To keep contact, he and the twins would whistle to each other from opposite ends of the column, making sure no one had drifted too far behind. Occasionally, he'd fall back to check on everyone. "I can tell what you're up to," I said once when he returned to the head of the line.
"What's that?"
"You pop back there when someone's lagging, start up a conversation. You ask David about the properties of phosphor, or Nadia about her freckles."
"I have never asked Nadia about her freckles."
"Or something. Then gradually you start to pick up the pace so that they're walking faster."
"It seems to work better than jabbing them with a stick," he said.
"Less fun.
My jabbing arm is tired."
Then he was gone, pressing ahead. It was the most we'd spoken since we'd left the White Cathedral. No one else seemed to have trouble talking. Tamar had started trying to teach Nadia some shoe ballads. Unfortunately, her memory was terrible, but her brother's was nearly perfect, and he'd eagerly taken over. The normally taciturn Tolia could recite entire cycles of epic poetry in Ravkin and Shu, even if no one wanted to hear them. Though Mal had ordered that we remain in strict formation, Jenya frequently escaped the front of the column to complain to me.
"Every poem is about a brave hero named Craigie," she said. "Every single one. He always has a steed, and we have to hear about the steed, and the three different kind of swords he carried, and the color of the scarf he wore tied to his wrist, and all the poor monsters he slew, and then how he was a gentleman and true." For a mercenary, Tolia is disturbingly maudlin.
I laughed and glanced back, though I couldn't see much. "How is David liking it?"
"David is oblivious. He's been babbling about mineral compounds for the last hour."
"Maybe he and Tolia will just put each other to sleep," Zoya grumbled.
She had no business griping, though they were all ethereal kai.
The only thing the squalors and Inferni seemed to have in common was how much they loved to argue. Stig didn't want Harshaw near him because he couldn't stand cats. Harshaw was constantly taking offense on Oncat's behalf. Adric was supposed to stay near the middle of the group, but he wanted to be close to Zoya. Zoya kept slipping away from the head of the column to try to get away from Adric. I was starting to wish I'd cut the rope and left them all to drown in the river. And Harshaw didn't just annoy me. He made me nervous. He liked to drag his flint along the cave walls, sending off little sparks. And he was constantly slipping bits of hard cheese out of his pocket to feed Oncat, then chuckling as if the tabby had said something particularly funny. One morning we woke to find that he had shaved the sides of his scalp so that his crimson hair ran in a single thick stripe down the center of his head.
"What did you do?" shrieked Zoya. "You look like a deranged rooster."
Harshaw just shrugged.
Oncat insisted.
Still, the tunnels occasionally surprised us, with wonders that rendered even the Ethereali speechless. We'd spend hours with nothing to look at but gray rock and mud-covered lime, then emerge into a pale blue cave so perfectly round and smooth that it was like standing inside a giant enamel egg. We stumbled into a series of little caves, glittering with what might well have been real rubies. Jenya dubbed it the Jewel Box, and after that we took to naming all of them to pass the time. There was the Orchard, a cavern full of stalactites and stalagmites that had fused together into slender columns. And less than a day later we came across the Dance Hall, a long cave of pink quartz, with a floor so slippery we had to crawl over it, occasionally sliding to our bellies. Then there was the eerie, partially submerged iron portcullis we called the Angel Gate. It was flanked by two winged stone figures, their heads bent, their hands resting on marble broadswords. The winch worked, and we passed through it without incident, but why had it been put there? And by whom? On the fourth day we came upon a cavern with a perfectly still pool that gave the illusion of a night sky, its depth sparkling with tiny luminescent fish. Mal and I were slightly ahead of the others. He dipped his hand in, then yelped and drew back.
"They bite!"
"Serves you right," I said. "Oh, look, a dark lake full of something shiny. Let me put my hand in it."
"I can't help being delicious," he said,
that familiar cocky grin flashing across his face like light over water. Then he seemed to catch himself. He shouldered his pack, and I knew he was about to move away from me. I wasn't sure where the words came from. "You didn't fail me, Mal." He wiped his damp hand on his thigh.
"We both know better.
We're going to be traveling together for who knows how long. Eventually, you're going to have to talk to me."
"I'm talking to you right now."
"See? Is this so terrible?"
"It wouldn't be,"
he said, gazing at me steadily,
"if all I wanted to do was talk."
My cheeks heated.
"You don't want this," I told myself.
But I felt my edges curl like a piece of paper held too close to fire. "Mal?"
"I need to keep you safe, Alina, to stay focused on what matters. I can't do that if..."
He let out a long breath.
"You were meant for more than me, and I'll die fighting to give it to you. But please don't ask me to pretend it's easy."
He plunged ahead into the next cave. I looked down at the glittering pond, the whorls of light in the water still settling after Mal's brief touch. I could hear the others making their noisy way through the cavern.
"Oncat scratches me all the time,"
said Harshaw as he ambled up beside me. "Oh?" I asked hollowly.
"Funny thing is, she likes to stay close."
"Are you being profound, Harshaw?"
"Actually, I was wondering, if I ate enough of those fish, would I start to glow?"
I shook my head. Of course, one of the last living Inferni would have to be insane. I fell in step with the others and headed into the next tunnel. Come on, Harshaw, I called over my shoulder. Then the first explosion hit.
Chapter 5. The whole cavern shook. Little rivulets of pebbles clattered down on us. Mal was beside me in an instant. He yanked me away from the falling rock as Zoya bracketed my other side. "Lights out," Mal shouted. "Packs off." We shoved our packs against the walls as a kind of buttress, then doused the lanterns in case the spark set off another explosion. Boom. Above us? North of us? It was hard to tell. Long seconds passed. Boom. This one was closer, louder. Rocks and soil rained down on our bent heads.
"He found us,"
moaned Sergei, his voice ragged with fear.
"He couldn't have," Zoya protested. "Even the apparat didn't know where we were headed."
Mal shifted slightly. I heard the smatter of pebbles.
"It's a random attack," he said.
Jenya's voice trembled when she whispered,
"That cat is bad luck."
Boom!
Loud enough to rattle my jaw.
"Metanyez," said David.
Marsh gas. I smelled it a second later, peaty and foul. If there were Inferni above us, a spark would follow and blow us all to bits. Someone started crying.
"Squallers," commanded Mal. "Send it east."
How could he sound so calm? I felt Zoya move, then the rush of air as she and the others drove the gas away from us.
Boom!
It was hard to breathe. The space seemed too small.
"All saints," Sergei quivered.
"I see flame," Tolia shouted.
"Send it east," repeated Mal, voice steady.
The whoosh of squaller wind followed. Mal's body was braced next to mine. My hand snaked out, seeking his. Our fingers twined together. I heard a small sob from my other side, and I reached for Zoya's free hand, taking it in mine.
Boom!
This time the whole tunnel roared with the sound of falling rock. I heard people shouting in the dark. Dust filled my lungs. When the noise stopped, Mal said,
"No lanterns. Alina, we need light."
It was a struggle, but I found a thread of sunlight and let it blossom through the tunnel. We were all covered in dust, eyes wide and frightened. I did a quick tally. Mal, Jenya, David, Zoya, Nadia, and Harshaw, Onkat tucked into his shirt.
"Tolia!"
shouted Mal. Nothing. Then,
"We're all right."
Tolia's voice came from behind the wall of fallen rock blocking the tunnel, but it was strong and clear. I pressed my head to my knees in relief.
"Where's my brother?"
yelled Nadia.
"He's here with me and Tamar,"
Tolia replied.
"Sergei and Stig?" I asked.
"I don't know."
"Saints."
We waited for another boom, for the rest of the tunnel to come down on top of us. When nothing happened, we started scrabbling toward Tolia's voice as he and Tamar dug from the other side. In a matter of moments, we saw their hands, then their dirty faces staring back at us. They scooted into our section of the tunnel. As soon as Adric dropped his hands, the ceiling above where he and the twins had been standing collapsed in a billow of dust and rock. He was shaking badly.
"You held the cave?"
Zoya asked. Tolia nodded.
"He made a bubble as soon as we heard that last boom."
"Huh," Zoya said to Adric. "I'm impressed." At the elation that burst over his face, she groaned.
"Never mind, I'm downgrading that to grudging approval."
"Sergei?" I called.
"Stig?"
Silence. The shift of gravel.
"Let me try something," said Zoya.
She raised her hands. I heard a crackling in my ears, and the air seemed to grow damp.
"Sergei?"
she said. Her voice sounded weirdly distant. Then I heard Sergei's voice, weak and trembling, but clear, as if he were speaking right beside me.
"Here,"
he panted. Zoya flexed her fingers, making adjustments, and called to Sergei again. This time when he replied, David said,
"It sounds like it's coming from below us."
"Maybe not," Zoya replied. "The acoustics can be misleading." Mal moved farther down the passage.
"No, he's right. The floor in their segment of the tunnel must have collapsed."
It took us nearly 2 hours to find them and dig them out, Tolia hefting soil, Mal calling directions, the squalor stabilizing the sides of the tunnel with air, as I maintained a dim illumination, the others forming a line to move rocks and sand. When we found Stig and Sergei, they were covered in mud and nearly comatose.
"Lowered our pulses," Sergei mumbled groggily. "Slow respiration. Use less air."
Tolia and Tamar brought them back, raising their heart rates and flushing their lungs with oxygen.
"Didn't think you'd come,"
slurred a still bleary Stig.
"Why?"
cried Jenya, gently brushing the dirt from around his eyes.
"I wasn't sure that you'd care,"
said Harshaw from behind me. There were mumbled protests and some guilty looks. I did think of Stig and Harshaw as outsiders. And Sergei? Well, Sergei had been lost for a while now. None of us had done a very good job of reaching out to them. When Sergei and Stig could walk, we headed back to the more intact part of the tunnel. One by one, the squalors released their power, as we waited to see if the ceiling would hold so they could rest. We brushed the dust and grime off one another's faces and clothes as best we could, then passed a flask of kvass around. Stig clung to it like a baby with a bottle.
"Everyone okay?" Mal asked.
"Never better," said Jenya shakily.
David raised his hand.
I've been better."
We all started laughing.
"What?"
he said.
"How did you even do that?" Nadia asked Zoya. "That trick with the sound."
"It's just a way of creating an acoustical anomaly. We used to play with it back in school so we could eavesdrop on people in other rooms."
Jenya snorted.
"Of course you did."
"Could you show us how to do it?"
asked Adric.
"If I'm ever bored enough." "Squallers," Mal said, "are you ready to move again?"
They all nodded. Their faces had the gleam that came with using Grisha power, but I knew they must already be approaching their limits. They'd been keeping tons of rock off us for half a mile, and they'd need more than a few minutes of rest to restore themselves.
"Then let's get the hell out of here," Mal said.
I lit the way, still wary of what surprises might be waiting for us. We moved cautiously, squalors on alert, twisting through tunnels and passages until I had no sense of which way we'd gone. We were well off the map that David and Mal had created. Every sound seemed magnified. Every fall of pebbles made us pause, frozen, waiting for the worst. I tried to think of anything but the weight of the soil above us. If the earth came down and the squalor's power failed, we would be crushed, and no one would ever know. Wildflowers pressed between the pages of a book and forgotten. Eventually, I became aware that my legs were working harder, and I realized the grade of the floor had turned steep. I heard relieved sighs, a few quiet cheers, and less than an hour later we found ourselves crowded into some kind of basement room, looking up at the bottom of a trapdoor. The ground was wet here, pocketed by little puddles, signs that we must be close to the river cities. By the light from my palms, I could see that the stone walls were cracked, but whether the damage was old or the result of the recent explosions, I couldn't tell.
"How did you do it?"
I asked Mal. He shrugged.
"Same as always. There's game on the surface. I just treated it like a hunt."
Tolia pulled David's old watch from the pocket of his coat. I wasn't sure when he'd acquired it.
"If this thing is keeping time right, we're well past sunset."
"You have to wind it every day," said David.
"I know that."
"Well, did you?"
"Yes."
"Then it's keeping time right."
I wondered if I should remind David that Tolia's fist was roughly the circumference of his head. Zoya sniffed.
With our luck, someone will be setting up for midnight mass.
Many of the entrances and exits to the tunnels were found in holy places, but not all of them. We might emerge in the asp of a church, or the courtyard of a monastery, or we might poke our heads out of the floor of a brothel.
And good day to you, sir.
I pushed down a crazed giggle. Exhaustion and fear were making me giddy. What if someone was waiting for us up there? What if the apparat had switched sides yet again and set the Darkling on our trail? I wasn't thinking straight. Mal believed the explosions had been a random attack on the tunnels, and that was the only thing that made sense. The apparat couldn't know where we'd be or when, and even if the Darkling had somehow found out that we were headed for Rivost, why bother using bombs to drive us to the surface? He could just wait for us to turn up there.
"Let's go," I said. "I feel like I'm suffocating."
Mal signaled for Tolia and Tamar to flank me.
"Be ready," he said to them. "Any sign of trouble, you get her out of here. Take the tunnels due west as far as you can."
It was only after he'd started climbing the ladder that I realized we'd all hung back, waiting for him to go first. Tolia and Tamar were both more experienced fighters, and Mal was the only Otkazatsia among us. So why was he the one taking the brunt of the risk? I wanted to call him back, tell him to be careful, but it would just sound absurd. Careful wasn't something we did anymore. At the top of the ladder, he gestured down at me, and I released the light, pitching us into darkness. I heard a thump, the sound of hinges straining, then a soft grunt and a creak as the trapdoor opened. No light flooded down, no shouts, no gunfire. My heart was pounding in my chest. I followed the sounds of Mal levering himself up, his footfalls above us. Finally, I heard the scrape of a match, and light bloomed through the trapdoor. Mal whistled twice, the all clear. One by one, we ascended the ladder. When I stuck my head through the trapdoor, a chill slid over my spine. The room was hexagonal, its walls carved from what looked like blue lapis, each studded with wooden panels painted with a different saint, their golden halos glinting in the lamplight. The corners were thick with milky cobwebs. Mal's lantern rested on a stone sarcophagus. We were in a crypt.
"Perfect," said Zoya. "From a tunnel to a tomb. What's next, an outing to a slaughterhouse?"
"Mesle," David said, pointing to one of the names carved into the wall. "They were an old Grisha family. There was even one of them at the little palace before..."
"Before everyone died," put in Jenya helpfully. "Ziva Mesle," Nadia said quietly. "She was a squaller."
"Can we host this salon somewhere else?" Zoya asked. "I want to get out of here."
I rubbed my arms. She had a point. The door looked like heavy iron. Tolia and Mal braced their shoulders against it as we arrayed ourselves behind them, hands raised, Inferni with their flints ready. I took my position in back, prepared to wield the cut if necessary.
"On three," Mal said.
A burble of laughter escaped me. Everyone turned. I flushed.
"Well, we're probably in a graveyard, and we're about to come charging out of a tomb."
Jenya giggled.
"If anyone's out there, we're going to scare the sneeze out of him."
With the barest hint of a grin, Mal said,
"Good point. Let's lead with an ooh."
Then the grin disappeared. He nodded at Tolia.
"Stay low."
He counted down, and they shoved. The bolts shrieked, and the tomb doors flew open. We waited, but there were no sounds of alarm to greet us. Slowly we filed out into the deserted cemetery. This close to the river, people buried their dead above ground in case of flooding. The tombs, arrayed in tidy rows like stone houses, gave the whole place the feel of an abandoned city. A wind blew through, shaking leaves free from the trees and stirring the grasses that grew up around the smaller gravesites. It was eerie, but I didn't care. The air was almost warm after the chill of the caves. We were outside at last. I tilted my head back, breathing deeply. It was a clear, moonless night, and after those long months underground, the sight of all that sky was dizzying, and so many stars. A glittering, tangled mess that seemed close enough to touch. I let their light fall over me like a balm, grateful for the air in my lungs, the night all around me.
"Alina,"
Mal said softly. I opened my eyes. The Grisha were staring.
"What?"
He took my hands and held them out in front of me, as if we were about to start a dance.
"You're glowing."
"Oh," I breathed. My skin was silver, cocooned in starlight. I hadn't even realized I was summoning.
"Oops."
He ran a finger down my forearm where the sleeve had ridden up, watching the play of light over my skin, a smile curling his lips. Abruptly, he stepped back. He dropped my hands as if they were hot.
"Be more careful," he said tightly.
He gestured to Adric to help Tolia reseal the crypt, then spoke to the group.
"Stay close and keep quiet. We need to find cover before dawn."
The others fell into step behind him, letting him lead yet again. I hung back, actively brushing the light from my skin. It clung to me as if my body was thirsty for it. When Zoya drew level with me, she said,
"You know, Starkov, I'm beginning to think you turned your hair white on purpose."
I flicked a speck of starlight from my wrist, watching it fade.
"Yes, Zoya, courting death is an integral part of my beauty regimen."
She shrugged and cast a glance at Mal.
"Well, it's a little obvious for my taste, but I'd say the whole moon maiden look is working."
The last person I wanted to talk to about Mal was Zoya, but that had sounded suspiciously like a compliment. I remembered her gripping my hand during the cave-in, and how strong she'd stayed throughout it all.
"Thanks," I said. "For keeping us safe down there. For helping save Sergei and Stig."
Even if I hadn't meant a word of it, the look of shock on her face would have been worth it.
"You're welcome," she managed.
Then she stuck her perfect nose in the air and added,
"But I won't always be around to save your ass, son summoner."
I grinned and followed her down the aisle of graves. At least she was predictable. It took us far too long to get out of the cemetery. The rows of crypts stretched on and on, cold testimony to the generations Ravka had been at war. The paths were raked clean, the graves marked with flowers, painted icons, gifts of candy, little piles of precious ammunition, small kindnesses even for the dead. I thought of the men and women bidding us goodbye at the White Cathedral, pressing their offerings into our hands. I was grateful when we finally cleared the gates. The terror of the cave-in and the long hours on our feet had taken their toll, but Mal was determined to get us as close to Rivost as he could before dawn. We trudged onward, marching parallel to the main road, keeping to the starlit fields. Occasionally we glimpsed a lone house, a lantern glowing in the window. It was a relief somehow to see these signs of life, to think of a farmer rising in the night to fill his cup with water, his head turning briefly to the window and the darkness beyond. The sky had just started to lighten when we heard the sounds of someone approaching on the road. We barely had time to scurry into the woods and take shelter in the brush before we glimpsed the first wagon. There were about 15 people in the convoy, mostly men, a few women, all bristling with weapons. I glimpsed bits and pieces of First Army uniforms, standard-issue trousers shoved into decidedly non-regulation cowhide boots, an infantry coat shorn of its brass buttons. It was impossible to tell what they were transporting. Their cargo had been covered by horse blankets and tightly secured to the wagon beds with rope.
"Militia?"
Tamar whispered.
"Could be," said Mal.
Not sure where a militia would get repeating rifles. If they're smugglers, I don't know any of them.
I could follow, said Tolia.
Why don't I just go do a waltz in the middle of the road? Tamar taunted.
Tolia was hardly quiet on his feet.
I'm getting better,
Tolia said defensively.
Besides,
Mal silenced them with a look.
Do not pursue. Do not engage.
As Mal led us deeper into the trees, Tolia grumbled.
You don't even know how to waltz.
We made camp in a clearing close to a slender tributary of the Sokol, the river fed by the glaciers in the Petrozoi and the heart of commerce in the port cities. We hoped we were far enough from town and the main roads that we wouldn't have to worry about anyone stumbling upon us. According to the twins, the smugglers' meeting place was in a busy square that overlooked the river in Rivost. Tamar already had a compass and a map in hand, though she must have been as tired as the rest of us. She would have to leave immediately to make it to town before noon. I hated letting her walk into what might be a trap, but we agreed that she would have to be the one to go. Tolia's size made him far too conspicuous, and none of the rest of us knew the way the smugglers worked or how to recognize them. Still, my nerves were jangling. I had never understood the twins' faith and what they were willing to risk for it. But when the time had come to choose between me and the apparat, they'd shown their loyalty in no uncertain terms. I gave Tamar's hand a quick squeeze.
Don't do anything reckless.
Nadia had been hovering nearby. Now she cleared her throat and kissed Tamar once on each cheek.
Be safe, she said.
Tamar flashed her heartrender's grin.
If anyone wants trouble, she said, flicking back her coat to reveal the handles of her axes. I've a fresh supply.
I glanced at Nadia. I had the distinct impression Tamar was showing off. She pulled up her hood and set out at a jog through the trees.
Yuya sesh,
Tolia called after her in Shu.
Niwe sesh,
she shouted over her shoulder. And then she was gone.
What does that mean?
It's something our father taught us,
Tolia replied.
Yuya sesh, despise your heart. But that's the direct translation. The real meaning is more like, do what needs to be done. Be cruel if you have to.
What's the other part?
Niwesesh? I have no heart.
Mal raised a brow.
Your dad sounds like fun.
Tolia smiled the slightly mad grin that made him look just like his sister.
He was.
I looked back the way Tamar had gone. Somewhere beyond the trees and the fields beyond that lay Rivost. I sent my own prayers with her. Bring back news of a prince, Tamar. I don't think I can do this alone. We laid out bedrolls and divvied up food. Adric and Nadia started raising a tent while Tolia and Mal scouted the perimeter, setting up stands where guards would be posted. I saw Stig trying to get Sergei to eat. I'd hoped that being above ground might bring him around, but though Sergei seemed less panicked, I could still feel tension coming off him in waves. In truth, we were all jumpy. As lovely as it was to lie beneath the trees and see the sky again, it was also overwhelming. Life in the White Cathedral had been miserable, but manageable. Up here, things felt wilder, beyond my control. Militias and the Darkling's men roamed these lands. Whether we found Nikolai or not, we were back in this war, and that meant more battles, more lives lost. The world seemed suddenly large again. I wasn't sure I liked it. I looked at our camp. Harsha, already curled up and snoozing, with Onkat on his chest, Sergei pale and watchful, David, back propped against a tree, a book in his hands, as Jenya fell asleep with her head in his lap. Nadia and Adric struggling with poles and canvas while Zoya looked on and didn't bother to help. Despise your heart. I wanted to.
I didn't want to grieve anymore, to feel loss or guilt or worry. I wanted to be hard, calculating. I wanted to be fearless. Underground, that had seemed possible. Here, in this wood, with these people, I was less sure. Eventually, I must have dozed, because when I woke, it was late afternoon, and the sun was slanting through the trees. Tolya was beside me.
"Tamar's back," he said.
I sat upright, fully awake, but the look on Tolya's face was grim.
"No one approached her?"
He shook his head. I straightened my shoulders. I didn't want anyone to see my disappointment. I should be grateful Tamar had made it in and out of the city safely.
"Does Mal know?"
"No," said Tolya. "He's filling canteens at the creek. Harshaw and Stig are on watch. Should I get them?"
"It can wait."
Tamar was leaning against a tree, gulping down water from a tin cup as the others gathered around to hear her report.
"Any trouble?" I asked.
She shook her head.
"And you're sure you were in the right place?" Tolya said.
"West side of the market square. I got there early, stayed late, checked in with the shopkeeper, watched the same damn puppet show 4 times. If the post is active, someone should have spoken to me."
"We could try again tomorrow," suggested Adric.
"Well, I should go," said Tolya. "You were there a long time. If you show up again, people may notice."
Tamar wiped her mouth with the back of her hand.
"If I stab the puppeteer, will that draw too much attention?"
"Not if you're quiet about it," replied Nadia.
Her cheeks pinked as we all turned to look at her. I'd never heard Nadia crack a joke. She'd mostly been an audience to Marie. Tamar slipped a dagger from her wrist and twirled it, balancing its point on one fingertip.
"I can be quiet," she said. "And merciful. I may let the puppets live."
She took another gulp of water.
"I heard some news, too. Big news. West Ravka has declared for Nikolai."
That got our attention.
"They're blocking off the western shore of the fold," she continued. "So, if the Darkling wants weapons or ammunition..."
"He'll have to go through Fjarda,"
finished Zoya.
But it was bigger than that. This meant the Darkling had lost West Ravka's coastline, its navy, the already tenuous access Ravka had to trade.
"West Ravka now," Tolya said. "Maybe the Shuhan next."
"Or Kerch," put in Zoya.
"Or both,"
crowed Adric. I could almost see the tendril of hope twisting its way through our ranks.
"So now what?"
Sergei asked, tugging anxiously at his sleeve.
"Let's wait one more day," Nadia said.
"I don't know," said Tamar. "I don't mind going back, but there were Oprichniki in the square today."
Not a good sign. The Oprichniki were the Darkling's personal soldiers. If they were prowling the area, we had good reason to move on as soon as possible.
"I'm going to go talk to Mal," I said. "Don't get too comfortable. We may need to be ready to leave in the morning."
The others dispersed while Tamar and Nadia walked off to dig through the rations. Tamar kept bouncing and spinning her knife, definitely showing off, but Nadia didn't seem to mind. I picked my way toward the sound of the water, trying to sort through my thoughts. If West Ravka had declared for Nikolai, that was a very good sign, that he was alive and well and making more trouble for the Darkling than anyone in the White Cathedral had realized. I was relieved, but I wasn't certain what our next move should be. When I reached the creek, Mal was crouching in the shallows, barefoot and bare-chested, his trousers rolled up to his knees. He was watching the water, his expression focused, but at the sound of my approach he shot to his feet, already lunging for his rifle.
"Just me,"
I said, stepping out of the woods. He relaxed and dropped back down, eyes returning to the creek.
"What are you doing out here?"
For a moment I just watched him. He stayed perfectly still. Then suddenly his hands plunged into the stream and emerged with a wriggling fish. He tossed it back, no point holding on to it when we couldn't risk making a fire to cook it.
I'd seen him catch fish this way at Keremsen, even in winter when Trivka's pond froze over. He knew just where to break the ice, just where to drop his line, or the moment to make his grab.